Welcome to another episode of the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes, the storytelling show that features The Clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to be told, and where all my guests have two things in common. They're all creative individuals and all with an interesting story to tell. There are some lovely storytelling metaphors. A clearing, a tree, a juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1, some alchemy, some gold, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So yes, welcome to the Good Listening To Show, your life and times with me, Chris Grimes. Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Get quite literally in. Welcome to a Facebook Live, and welcome, welcome, thrice welcome to a gorgeous, lovely man, Mr. Robert Hands, who is a gorgeous actor. And this is, I'll blow a bit of happy smoke at you shortly. We've got history, I'll get into that. But don't forget, you're listening to the Good Listening To Show, where I invite movers, makers, shakers, mavericks, influencers, and also personal heroes. You'll see where Rob fits right in all of those, along to the clearing or serious happy place of their choosing, to all share with us their stories of distinction and genius. And it's my great pleasure to invite you into the clearing, Rob. We have history. We go way back when. We actually graduated in the same year together at the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, not to ages both, but circa many, many, many years ago. And I have the most brilliant abiding memory of your graduating, by the way. Two things. In our final year, you played Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream beautifully, and I was blown away by you. Not just being nice to you, it's the truth. And then there's an apocryphal story, which I think you've since denied, where you were taken on by Scott Marshall. And then the story was that somebody, either Scott Marshall themselves or a representative, was cycling across London with your CV in their lady basket as they rode across London in order to furnish Michael Pennington from the English Shakespeare Company with your CV. Marvellous. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Robert Hands.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for asking.
That's what you're welcome. So that was a little bit of happy smoke at you. I know, yeah. You know who you are, but you are an Olivier Award nominated actor. You've had a very, very illustrious career. Also, very interestingly as well, there's a sort of dark side to what I know we're going to be talking about as well. But it's so, so profound and wonderful. And I'm so happy to see you the right way up. Lovely man.
So much. Thank you. So,
how's morale? What's your story of the day, first of all, Robert Hanson?
Well, I've got a really stinking cold, I tell you that, really bad. It's actually, since I've been looking at your face, it's sort of dried up a bit, but it was streaming in a sort of comical way. People on the tube just now were sort of moving away from me because they thought I was some sort of lunatic crying or something. But
They thought the next zombie apocalypse was starting opposite them or next to
them.
Yeah,
sort of red-rimmed eyes, a sort of pale face. I had a little lie down just then, and I feel the benefit of that.
Bless you for lying down before you speak to me. And as I said just a few moments ago, before we pressed record, it's like we're twins because I too have a cold. And as, you know, two men sharing the tribulations of man flu, we know how bad it is.
Hear that. Yes, poor you.
And pour you right back at you. So, yes, and apart from that, it's extremely welcome. Sorry, you're extremely welcome. That wasn't English, that bit there. So it's going to be my great joy and delight to curate you through a clearing, a tree. There's a lovely, juicy storytelling exercise called 5-4-3-2-1. Bless you. There'll be some alchemy, some gold, a couple of random squirrels, a cheeky bit of Shakespeare, a golden baton, and a cake. So it's all to play for. So as you know, there's going to be an invitation and an invocation to go as deep as you like, when you like, where you like. And just to finally position, it could be described as sort of the wilderness years that all actors experience, but very, very profoundly. I know that, well, I watched a really extraordinary film, which you very bravely made, which is called The School of Rock Bottom, a podcast. And the title of which, rather profoundly, is From Injecting Crystal Meth to the Olivier Awards, which is an extraordinary title, and I was very struck by that. But I know we'll be talking about some of that. But that's not the main reason. I want to just blow some very happy smoke at you in what we talk about.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I'll definitely be touching on that, because that's so much part of who I am today. So Yes, we will definitely go into that. In fact, it'll be my first thing that shaped me will be getting clean and how that happened.
So let's get you on the open road. So first of all then, the clearing. Welcome to the clearing, where all good questions come to get asked and all good stories come to get told. So it's a serious happy place of your choosing, and thank you for preparing and thinking about this. And obviously I don't know till you tell me, but where does Robert Hands, a gorgeous actor, go to get clutter-free, inspirational and able to think?
Well, when I first thought about it, I just thought of it as a sort of straightforward, what places do I like? And I love nature. Nature's very important to me, and it's very sort of restorative to me, to, you know, my mental health and stuff. But truthfully, the place where I am clear-minded and receptive and present is when I'm meditating, which I do every day. And has I never thought I'd be that guy. I never thought I'd be that guy. People used to talk about meditation. Oh, please. I don't know if you remember, at drama school, we used to have the voice teacher used to every now and then do a sort of relaxation thing, and everyone's saying, oh, I love it, oh, let's get on the clouds. I couldn't wait to get off the cloud. It was not the place where I was at all.
I think that's somebody called Lynette or Francis Thomas from memory.
It was Francis Thomas, yes. Yeah. And everyone loved it so much, and I felt like an alien because I didn't like it at all. It was the longest hour of my life that we spent on that cloud. You know, my head hurt, my legs hurt, you know, everything. I wanted to twitch. I couldn't do it. But anyway, now I do it, I guess, religiously. Yes. And I guess it's changed me. It's changed the way I am. So, yes, I would like to meet you in my meditative state. That's all right.
Thank you. And yes, please. And is it a post, I know we're going to go there, but is it a sort of newer practice post-recovery, or is it Absolutely. Part of your recovery?
It's hand in hand of what keeps me going. Yes.
Yes. And in your meditative state, I know you said, get me off the cloud. I'm assuming we're not in a sort of wafty, wafty cloudyscape with your meditative state.
No, we're not really. No, we're not in a physical place at all. I think I'm just present with my breath. I think that's it. When my eyes closed and present, focusing on that, that's all I do. There's nothing very technical or complicated about it. It's as simple as that. And who would have thought that that simple act sort of changed my life, really? Yeah, it's changed the man I am, definitely. And my ability to deal with things and just gets me through. And it's such a simple thing, and it's free. That's the other thing. It doesn't even cost anything. You don't even, you know, you can do it anywhere. And I think that was why I had such trouble with it, is because there's, in a way, there's so little to it, but the benefits are immense.
It's an extraordinary testament to, you know, how the older we get, the better actors we become, because actually we truly appreciate presence more. I don't, you know, you're a phenomenally gifted actor, that's a given, but I don't doubt you're an even better actor now because of your having found that meditative state place.
Yeah, I hope that'd be nice. I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah. So if I may, then I'm going to arrive then a bit Waiting for Godot-esque existentially with a tree in your meditative state clearing. And by the way, you're the first guest in nearly 200 episodes that's just said it is the meditative state. And I'm really happy about that.
Good. That's nice.
And it's present with your breath, which I'm compelled by repeating, because I think that's just a lovely thing to have said. So I'm going to shake your tree now to see which storytelling apples fall out. And then how do you like these apples? It's 5 minutes to have thought about four things that have shaped you, three things that inspire you, two things that never fail to grab your attention and borrow from the film Up. As listeners will know, having listened to many episodes now, that's all squirrels. You know what never fails to grab your attention, irrespective of anything else that might be going on for you in your hectic life, even though I've got you meditating now. And then the one is a quirky or unusual fact about your actor, Robert Hands. We couldn't possibly know about you until you tell us. So over to you, and I'll guide you through it. It's not a memory test. So interpret the shaking of your canopy as you see fit.
Right, and the first thing that has shaped my life is that 10 years ago today, Chris, I got clean. So it's funny that we've bumped this along for various reasons. I wasn't going to make it, then you couldn't make it, and it's happened all today. And today was the day. 10 years ago today, I got clean. In that, I stopped taking mind-altering drugs of any sort. It was the last time I did it. It was 10 years ago today. It might have been 10 years ago yesterday. Perhaps today is my first day clean. I 10 years ago today, I had no hope. I had no love. I certainly couldn't see any of those things, whether I had them or I hadn't. I had lost my career. I hadn't worked for 2 years. I was living in a flat that I'd sort of demolished in a sort of mania of crystal meth addiction. Of I don't quite know what I thought I was doing, but I thought, you know, I've got to have, you know, I wanted everything perfect, but I didn't have any skills to put it right, or indeed any funds to put it right. And it was the end of the road. There was no way out, and I'd backed myself into a corner. And I don't know really how it happened. I was using with someone who said, I'm going to stop this. This is going to be the last time I do it, because when you inject drugs into your veins, the likelihood of getting a stroke increases as you near 50. And I was 49 at the time. And I don't know, through the haze of what I was doing, I sort of felt like someone was throwing down the gauntlet. And I thought, well, I'm going to stop as well then. And I don't quite know where that thought came from, because up until then, I'd felt a slight pity for the rest of the world, that I was in this parallel universe and I was the cool guy, and all these poor saps, you know, having to, you know, live their lives and go to work and earn money and all those things, that they were somehow the losers. It's very interesting that from that day to this, I never once heard from the people I used to take drugs with. Not once did anyone ever get in touch and say, "Hey, Rob, how's it going?" Because it wasn't about that. It wasn't about love. It wasn't about friendship. It was, or connection, or any of those things. It was just about sort of self-serving, self-seeking, what you can get out of the situation. You know, hey, this guy's got a derelict flat, we'll go around there. And I didn't know what to do with myself, having made this decision. I never imagined I'd take crystal meth, and I never imagined I would inject it. They were things that other people did. I'm rather a good boy. I sort of always have been. And both those things ended up happening. I remember the first time I heard about it, someone saying, "Oh, there's this stuff on the streets, and it's the most addictive thing you can get hold of. You know, it's ruined my life." And I remember thinking, "Well, that's not something I'm going to be doing." And in the event when someone offered me some, I just said, "Yeah, all right." And then when someone said that he thought that we should inject it, I thought, well, we'll do it. Well, another time, I said. And then he talked me around within seconds, within a minute. I had a needle in my arm. And
I mean, that's the most extraordinary, extraordinary line to cross, the idea of suddenly deciding. I mean, just the two words, crack cocaine and then inject crack cocaine. It's just so sub-next level despair. Into the depths of hell, one would imagine.
It's actually now crystal meth, not crack cocaine. It's crystal meth.
Sorry. Yes.
I even as I relate it, I don't quite know why I didn't go, "Yeah, on your bike, mate. No thanks. You can do it, but I'm not doing it." I don't know why I didn't, yes. But I did. And
I mean, with hindsight, do you know why? I mean, by the way, this is so profound. Thank you so much for being so honest about
it. Yeah, you should go as deep as you like. Well, we're kicking off with deep.
Yes, and I'm right there, absolutely.
But why not? It was 10 years ago today, and we're talking about my life.
Congratulations, by the way. That's a really extraordinary thing to say. And I was blown away by the anniversary when you said, it's today. I thought, oh, crikey, that's amazing.
Yeah. I don't know. To this day, I don't know why I was that suggestible and why I was so willing to please someone else when they didn't give a damn about my life. But it was almost like that. It was like, oh, well, he says it's a good idea. Well, that's all right. With enough conviction, I said, oh, I'll go enough. And it, you know, I suppose my journey since then has been to learn who I am and what I will and won't do nowadays. And I think now I have a firmer hold on that. Yes, I did that, and the descent was very rapid, and I sort of lost everything of any value very, very quickly. And I ended up, you know, in this tiny, tiny flat that I'd bought it because I had some money from the breakup of a relationship, and we sold our flat, and I bought this flat really because I kind of thought I could flag down a dealer if I could, you know, I'd open a window because it was in Camden. It was a studio flat, really. That was genuinely my thinking behind it. But then there I was, having made this decision to stop it, and nowhere.
I mean, there's a rationale now, as we can both admire, that's sort of from a distance now, that's sort of, as a logic, that's a bit unhinged, isn't it?
Yeah, the whole thing was unhinged. I mean, it was nonsense. I mean, I don't know how I got to be that person. I don't know how it happened. It was happened quite quickly. I didn't do it for years and years and years. I did it for perhaps 2 years, if that.
I mean, it's a real a surprise as well, because I never perceived you as being somebody so impressionable. You know, you were much more of a sort of golden boy with a great career coming up. So there was so much positivity and vibrancy and life to you. And I didn't, there was no, I mean, everybody can have a sort of sinkhole of despair given the circumstances. But it's fascinating how you went, you know, you were at that edge to tip into that sinkhole.
Yes. I guess addiction doesn't, you know, it doesn't mind whether you're that rather glamorous person you described that I don't particularly recognise. They don't mind whether you're that or you come from from a life of far less privilege. It doesn't sort of make any distinction between those things. It's in you.
Sort of relatively but tangentially, in the world of comedy improvisation, there's an adage which is your first idea is from God, your second idea is from the devil. So the yin-yang moment of you tipping into the bowl of despair, it's almost like that obviously, you know, wasn't from God, that was from the devil, and you went, all right then, like a binary choice, yes, no.
I mean I'd always struggled with a slightly compulsive and addictive personality. I'd real issues with food. I was always putting on weight and taking it off, and a real kind of compulsion around that, and then I discovered alcohol, and that became a big thing. And that I had to knock that on the head when I was 28, because it was certainly messing with my head, of this obsession with when am I going to have the next one. So I'd always had it about me, and for what it's worth, it had been in my family as well. My father was alcoholic, and he died of it, actually. And some of my brothers have had sort of issues as well, and it seems to be something that pops up in my family quite a lot.
By the way, I'm struck with how you're the seven ages of man, which we're coming on to later, but how when I first reconnected with you just before Christmas, I know you've also had your mum die as well. So it's so wonderful that you're the right way up, as I keep saying, and it's lovely. And again, congratulations for the 10 years of being dry. And presumably that means you're dry, meaning alcohol as well. Is that right?
Yes, that no mind-altering substance passes my lips or nose or veins or wherever it may be. Yeah. Yes. And it was a real, you know, you say the question is, what, you know, what shaped you? What it was, getting clean was the hardest thing I've ever done. So I
and you talk about 28 when the alcohol was given up. What in the timeline? When was the 10 years ago? Obviously, you had 20 years to then stop, because obviously
I mean, I didn't take up the crystal meth until the last 2 years. So perhaps when I suppose 12 years ago, I guess I took it up.
There's real Breaking Bad territory as well. That's the substance in Breaking Bad that everyone.
Yes, it is. And funnily, I remember watching that actually when I was doing it and thinking, well, it's not like that. You know, all these people seem to lead perfectly normal lives. You can't lead. Well, I couldn't lead a normal life when I was doing it. I couldn't function. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't hold down a job or keep a room tidy or any of those things. The minute I was on it, it was a mess. I couldn't function at all. There's that expression, a functioning alcoholic. Well, to me, it was quite, and I did, I guess, function as an alcoholic, but I certainly didn't function as a crystal meth user.
And it's so, you obviously got your career back. So I know you had a 3-year impasse where everything stopped for the reasons you're explaining, but it's brilliant that you got your career back. Hence the crystal meth to the Olivier Award.
Yeah, I had to get this. I had to get a job because the minute the stuff started leaving my system, I could see all the more clearly that, oh my God, I was in complete trouble. And I've had a very charmed career. I've never really done anything else. And the thing is, I'd lost my self-confidence through what had happened with the drugs. And so I thought, well, I can't act anymore. I'm not sure I want to, but then who am I if I'm not an actor? Because it's all I've ever wanted to do, really. So anyway, I got this job through meeting someone who knew someone who knew someone in an office in Croydon of a trade magazine. It's called the Water, Sewerage and Waste magazine. And they were my home.
It's one of my subscriptions.
Well, it's a must read. But they were my home for 2 years, and I think I told the boss about it finally, and she sort of said, I'll look after you, don't you worry. And so I worked there at not very much money, but I had somewhere to go. I needed some sort of structure to my life. And it took, you know, a while for the flat to get put back in order and to be habitable. And then eventually I got an audition for a little play at the Hampstead Theatre. And I got it. And then looking back, it was just the right time. I was ready to start doing it. And then I went straight back to the office, to the Water, Sewerage and Waste magazine. And then I got another little play at the Trafalgar Studios, I remember. And then I got a few episodes of a TV thing. And then all of a sudden I got a West End musical. And then oh my God, I'm an actor again.
And was that Come From Away at that point, or have I got the timeline wrong?
No. It was called Mrs. Henderson Presents.
Oh, yes.
And all of a sudden I earned enough money in that time that it was not very long, but just enough to keep me out of the Water, Sewerage and Waste magazine and to start becoming a jobbing actor again. And things got better and better. And I momentum and confidence.
And by the way, a trajectory from crystal meth to water and sewage doesn't sound that big a distance, does
no,
it?
No, that's more of a, yeah, it's a pit stop. Yes,
yeah, that lovely.
Yes. And then what happened? And then I became, you know, really busy and really happily. So.
And did your agent stick by you throughout this, or have you changed agents?
Yeah, I told him what had happened.
Yes.
He was extraordinarily kind and supportive, and still is, actually.
Is it Scott Marshall still?
No, it's not, actually. No, it's not. For various reasons I won't go into, but there have been a couple along the way since then. Well, not least one of them, I had to go because I was hard at my drug addiction, and obviously
That wasn't the best thing on your CV at the time.
No.
Not really. Shall we say, marvellous.
But eventually, yes, I started you know, it's all started to pick up again. And then you mentioned Come From Away, and that was a lovely musical that come over from Broadway, and it had been a big hit there. And it was about a community that had taken on 38 planes during 9/11 that had been rerouted there.
Yeah.
And were obliged to look after them. And it's a very theatrical telling of that story. There are only 12 people in the show, and we played, you know, the resident Canadian community as well as the people on the planes. And we,
yes.
And I had a really lovely storyline through that.
And this is your Olivier nomination.
Yes. And then I
went. Yes. One of your wonderful career moments that I remember seeing many years after I left you at the Old Vic Theatre School was when you played the original Sir Robin in the original cast of Spamalot. And I came to see you in that. Yeah. And Monty Python is my thing, and Michael Palin is my all-time comic hero. So it was just absolutely wonderful that I saw that. And I came to see, and I can't remember how many years that was post 1988.
Oh, it was about 2006.
So I came to see Brave Sir Robin Runaway. I came to see you in Spamalot, which was lovely.
Yeah, in 2006, I think that was.
And by the way, that was the most profound number one shapage. I mean, absolutely profound. Is there anything else you'd like to say about that shapage?
No, I'm extreme. No, he says, and then says something. I'm very grateful for it, that it happened to me. And I feel very humbled by it, because I don't know how it happened.
Yes. And it wasn't planned. It wasn't because your marriage was failing or anything like that, was it? It wasn't as linear as that. It was, and I, in the documentary I watched as well, you said there was just a sort of impasse or a period in your life when you'd suddenly realised there was just no love around, you said, and it was no love for my, just no love for work, that just some mojo had just been dented. And I wondered whether that was because you were using, but actually it wasn't. That's just when you presumably became more susceptible to it, rather.
No, the no love and the no hope was because I was using.
Right, I'm with you.
The minute I started using, those things can't cohabit with drug addiction. Well, it couldn't for me anyway.
Okay, so now in the structure of it, it's the second thing that has shaped you.
Right. Well, I'm afraid it's another rather heavy thing.
No, please, that's fine. This is so good, by the way.
So the second thing is growing up gay. And I really struggled with it. It was not something that was like water off a duck's back to me at all. I didn't know what it was. I'd never heard of such a thing. I knew I wasn't quite like everyone else, but I didn't have the imagination to think I will. And I was too young to know what was going on particularly. But I remember staying with, I was 10, and we were staying with some family friends. And I was brought up in Holland. And the only English that I heard until I was 10 was either my brothers, who were at boarding school in England. I wasn't. I went to school in Holland. Or my mother's English. My mother had sort of rather posh 1950s English. And so we were staying with these family friends. And the boy that lived there was the same age as me. And we were talking about something. And I said, well, that's very queer. And I can remember his lip curling and him saying, you know what that is, don't you? And I said, yes, it means strange or odd or unusual. He went, it means two men doing it, he said. I knew instantly that this was not a good thing to be, that I was it and I didn't want to be it. I can remember the moment. I can remember the room. I haven't been there since, but I can remember the whole thing about it. It was like the lighting changed. I knew instantly all those things. And there I was, and this is, I think, an experience that a lot of gay people share, is you're alone. You're completely alone. You've got nowhere to go with it. You cannot have a conversation about it. This is before the internet. It's before, we live in far more enlightened times now. It's the ultimate insult in the schoolyard. It's the only representations of gay people, as far as I was aware, were Larry Grayson on The Generation Game. was a sort of a joke, a laughing stock, not you know, you laughed at them as much as with them. Or that's how I perceived it. And there I was, fighting these quite natural urges, but just wanting them to go away. And as I got older, I became, you know, half bits of information would trickle down. And I'd heard that, oh, it's a phase, you grow out of it. I thought, well, perhaps it's a phase. And then I'd be really on that, well, how long does the phase last? As I got to be older and older and older, and it didn't seem to be going away. And it's a kind of torturous thing of trying to, being so self-aware, of trying to throw people off the scent, and by being a bit of a sort of Romeo, you know, lots of girlfriends, and being, of course, because I'm very good at talking to girls. I don't feel self-conscious because I don't really want anything in that way out of them. I'm very comfortable talking to women, but and the loneliness. I feel such affection for that little boy now, but I didn't for the longest time. And of course, really open to being bullied, because I didn't want to stand out in any way. But children are pretty tough on each other. They smell difference, but go for it. They're not going to go, you know, hey, yeah, Rob's a little bit different, you know.
Such a great expression, by the way, very powerful. If they smell different, that's a really lovely way to put it.
Yeah, and of course, I didn't really have any problem with the things that people said and did to me. I think my whole life has been about forgiving myself for allowing those things to happen. But I had no one to talk to. I had no support.
And there's no contact with this boyhood friend, presumably. He's just someone that's disappeared.
Well, he wasn't actually a friend. He was my mother's friend's son.
Okay.
So we didn't live in the same place. They lived in the Midlands, and we were just staying with them for a summer. So, I mean, I know of him. I know he's still around.
And did he, yeah. I'm just intrigued to ask, did he end up gay as well? Because there's an irony sometimes.
Oh, yeah, no, he's not. Well, like, maybe, but I know he's married with children, so yes. I wouldn't have thought that married to a woman with children. I have great compassion for that thing of just having to work it all out yourself. There was a book by E.M. Forster called Morris, which, and I was doing Howards End at school, and so I knew about this other book that he'd written, that was famously about a gay love affair. And I remember going to the bookshop and buying it and coming home with it and hiding it under my pillow so no one saw it, and reading it in an afternoon. And the feeling of, it was the only moment, I mean, how ridiculous, the only identification I could have was with a book written in 1925 or whenever it was written, which was published posthumously. It wasn't published until he died, because it was illegal to talk about such things. It really shaped me, that loneliness of being unable to share with anyone. And there wasn't any weight behind it, but there was casual homophobia from both my parents. They didn't be in their bonnet about it. They weren't sort of table thumping, but you know, the odd, they'd let the odd thing slip. About, you know, my father used to say, well, I'm really queer as a coot, you know, things like that, you know, and I'd feel this when you'd say things like that. I think, so am I, maybe it'll go away and they won't ever find out. I don't know why I so badly didn't want to be it. I don't know why so badly, because other people really didn't hold on to it for as long as I did. But I held on to it right through my 20s. I still kept sort of kind of hoping it would go away.
Wow. The hope is they were accepting, your dad was accepting, and I know your mum's not with us anymore. Is your father still with us?
No, he's not. He's not. But actually, no, when I finally got round to telling them, and I wish I'd done it so much sooner than I did, I mean, there was a few tiny hiccups, there was a little bit of awkwardness, but essentially it was fine.
Yes.
They were. It's not like they were down the gay pride parade blowing a whistle. They weren't those sort of people.
Yes.
But at the same time, we got to a place of complete ease about the whole thing.
Wonderful. These are such profound shapages, by the way. Thank you. Do you want to go to shapage number three now, please? Which is
maybe not three.
Cashier number three. So shapage number three, please.
It's quite difficult to talk about, but it is my spirituality. And before I got clean, I would never have imagined I'd become the guy I am. And my spirituality isn't centered on any religion. There's no religious faith at all that I have. But it lies in meditation. It lies in stillness and it lies in yoga. Yeah, I am that guy. I am the yoga meditating guy. And it provides me with a perspective of my place in the world. And in the best way, how unimportant I am in the scheme of things. And it helps tremendously with anything that happens in my life. I've become very kind of accepting of things, which, you know, I might not have. And I would have, I wish I'd found it so much sooner. It sustained me through my recovery from drug addiction as well. It's something else to call on. I guess I'm less likely now to look for approval from people or from work or from whatever it may be, excuse me, than I would have been before.
Mm-hmm. So there's sort of an I'm at peace now is what I'm hearing.
Well, I mean, it's contingent on me doing the stuff, really. It's contingent.
Yes. Meditation. It's a practice to be peaceful.
Exactly. And to do yoga and to, you know, I write a gratitude list. I write a list of 10 things I'm grateful for every day.
Yes.
To keep me in a place of, you know, even when things are bad. And of course things are bad. It's not like, you know, now I've discovered meditation and yoga, everything is fine. Of course it's not. Life happens.
Yes.
But it somehow gives me I don't have to fill up myself with food or drugs or sex or whatever. I don't need to do those things anymore.
I'm sort of hearing you don't need to seek validation anymore. You just are and at peace with that practice.
I think that's the journey, Chris. I don't think I've arrived. I don't think that's somewhere I'll ever arrive, but yeah. I can see I'm on that path. Yes.
There's a quest towards that.
Yes, I can see that now. And it's not to say that I don't have ambition and drive. I absolutely have those in spades. But at the same time, I find with auditions, I can give them 100%.
Yes.
But then I can walk out the room and I more or less let them go.
Yes.
Because I never thought I'd be an actor again. I never thought I'd own property. I never thought any of these things were going to happen to me. And they happened, and they happened in their own time.
Yes.
And I have lots of experiences like that. In COVID, I didn't work at all during COVID. And then all of a sudden, it all came back, and it came back in a sort of avalanche of work and indeed money came my way.
Yes.
I guess I don't know. I don't know what's next in store, and I'm quite comfortable being in that place.
Lovely. And the final shapage of the four shapages.
Well, the final shapage, which could well have been the first shapage, really. Which was my love of theatre. And when I was 10, we moved from Holland to England, and my aunt took me to the pantomime. And the Windsor
Theatre. Yes, she did. I'm sorry, that was a stupid joke. Sorry. What? I said, oh, yes, she did. I'm sorry, that's so kind of obvious.
And it was the Windsor Theatre or Panto. And I just remember being bewitched by it. I just remember sitting there thinking, and there were children on stage as well, people like me running around, acting really badly, I have to say, as well. And thinking, why are they doing it like that? I wouldn't do it like that. But I became I straight away became obsessed with it. And I didn't go to the theatre for a whole nother year, to the Panto again the next year. And I remember my aunt buying me a programme and I read it forwards, backwards, sideways. I was obsessed with it from that moment.
I love that.
And I guess, you know, when I talked about the loneliness of being a gay boy growing up in London, I guess that was my only outlet. And it was the only thing. I didn't really care what people thought about that. It was my thing. Yes. And it sustained me. So it was my friend. It really was. And I was quite chunky because I mentioned, you know, that I had the kind of food issue. And I started saving my dinner money. And in those days, you could do that. You could save your dinner money and then you could go into London from where we lived and go and see a play. And you'd sit 4 miles from the stage, but you could see a play for £3.
Yeah.
And I did it every Friday. And my parents used to get the Times newspaper and I used to rush downstairs. It was quite a sort of quirky, geeky child, really. But I guess I felt very alone. So to read the theatre reviews.
Yeah.
And I used to read them avidly. I couldn't wait to get downstairs to read it. Still haven't read a newspaper, really. But I'd go straight for the theatre reviews. And I became this geeky expert on directors and writers and playwrights. And through that, I went to see the most extraordinary things. I remember going to see, you know, plays in pub theatres and seeing lots of things at the RSC and musicals and I remember I always bought a theatre programme and I used to read those like people read books. I loved knowing about actors and where they came from and what they'd done. Excuse me, what they'd done and particularly where they're trained. Actually, that was a real thing.
Yes.
What drama schools they'd gone to. It was a completely solitary activity that wasn't in any way encouraged or supported by anyone else.
It came from within, yes.
Yeah, it came from within. It was my happy place, I suppose.
Yes.
I loved it.
That's so brilliant about this episode, because when you're interviewing an actor, you think, okay, what's your serious happy place? Oh, darling, it's the stage. And then we go from then on. But this has been so extraordinary that the fourth shape, which is obviously theatre, and it's yours from within.
Yeah.
So with your permission, I'd like to get on to three things that inspire you now, actor Robert yes. Hand.
So, as you mentioned, and forgive me if I get a little tearful, my mother died on November the 11th, 2023. So that's kind of 3 months ago. And she died on her 96th birthday. And she had had dementia and hadn't really been herself for about 6 years. And I had really been filling in the gaps all that time. And because I wanted to, obviously. But actually, it sort of was her time. And when she died, I did look at her and I kind of think, I've never seen anyone look so old or so dead. And I know it's sort of slightly funny, and it sort of was funny, really. She was just, she'd come to the end of the road and I do feel sad and I feel my eyes pricking over and above the cold about it. But actually, it was okay. But she was a great inspiration to me. She, without any formal education, she became a journalist in Fleet Street and had at a time when women didn't have careers, and women weren't expected to have careers. There was a whole thing of, you know, you get a job until you marry, but she actually had a career and no one helped her with it. She just had talent. She had a gift with words. She was a very, very good writer. And she never went to university, and she had this slight, I don't know if it was a chip on her shoulder, but it was something that she felt needed addressing. Everyone that she worked with, particularly as time went on, had degrees. And as she got older, younger women were coming in to do what she did, who all had been to university. And my mother really, really envied it. She actually trained as an actress. My mother went to Central School for a year. And then didn't really pursue it. She didn't really get anywhere with it. And then ended up in this strange publication in Fleet Street. But she ended up, you know, being working at all the kind of major women.
You wasn't the editor of the sewage and waterworks.
Busted. That's how I got the job. No. They weren't based in Fleet Street.
They were a bit of nepotism for the old sewage works. Sorry, I was kidding.
Yeah, pulled a string there for me. But then when in her 70s, she went to university.
Wow.
Got on the bus and she went to university and did an English degree, which is what she'd always wanted to do. And at the time, you know, I kind of took it as normal, but, you know, she was in her 70s and she was sitting in a classroom full of 18, 19-year-olds. And she had a really difficult life. My father was an alcoholic and I had three brothers, and she was sort of the major breadwinner, and she never had much interest in domesticity. That wasn't really her thing. But God, she did what she could. You know, there was always food on the table. We were never dressed particularly elegantly or well, but and the house was a bit of a mess. Really, she just couldn't see the point. She could not see the point in cleaning.
And we can all relate to that. Yes, it's called wilding your front room nowadays.
But God, get her on a subject of a book or something that she'd read, and she'd be so inspiring and engaging and interested. She was interested in everything. So yes, she's a huge inspiration to me. That, in a way, she followed her heart. That's what she did.
I'm sorry to hear that. Obviously, dementia took the final hold. And how long was her path in that?
6 years. When she was 90, she fell over, and that speeded up the process. Seeming that's a thing that a trauma can bring it on or speed it up or something. And she was never quite the same after that. Although physically, she sort of, you know, she started to be able to walk about a bit, and she lived alone until the last, actually. But she certainly wasn't herself anymore, and it was heartbreaking watching her. If I said something like, "I've got a job," you know, I could see a flush across her eyes. "What do you mean you've got a job? Does that mean you don't normally have a job? What's the job? What is it you do? Did I know this? Have we had a conversation about it?" You could see, and so instead of asking any questions like, "Oh, what's the job?" she'd go, and it was, well, it was sad, really, because it meant, you know, we could no longer really communicate. Yes. It became really hard.
And by the way, our connection times are quite profound in the fact it's 10 years to this day that you are dry or in recovery. And when I first reconnected with you, you were literally traveling in the car to go and see your mum, and then a week later she died. And then since that point, we've been getting to this point, which is obviously since November to now. So it's an extraordinary series of connections that brings us to the presence of now.
Good point. Yes, I agree. Yeah, it is nice. Yeah. Anyway, then I've lumped a few together, things that inspire
Please
me.
Do. Yeah, so this is the second inspirer.
I have a thing about people who have overcome hardship. And last year I read three autobiographies, and there were people who faced far greater difficulties than I ever did. And they didn't just transcend them, they triumphed. One is a book called Educated by Tara Westover. And she was brought up.
Tara, did you say?
Tara Westover.
Tara, sorry. Yeah.
And she was brought up in a very strict Mormon family in Utah, I believe. Her father didn't believe in medicine or education, and they ran a sort of breaker's yard, I think, and it was pretty crazy. And it transpired later, I think, that her dad was bipolar, and he'd have these episodes that they all suffered by, and she had no education whatsoever, and by and she hadn't been to school until she was 16. She home educated, but mostly on the Bible. There was not a great deal of and her mum sort of on the quiet educated, and she managed to get into college. It was a Mormon college, but it was frowned upon by her father, and there was all sorts of physical abuse and stuff, and it was an extremely difficult life. And a teacher there, because it's often the way, a teacher spotted her sort of brilliance. The long and short of it, she ended up at Cambridge. This girl with no education. She said, like, when she went to college, she didn't know that she had to brush her teeth or have a shower every day. That they were that sort of removed from society. She ended up in Cambridge, and then she then went to Harvard. These great sort of establishments of education from this extraordinary humble beginnings, not just humble, but they didn't want her to get on. That was not what they felt that she was there for. As a Mormon woman, that was not expected. Anyway,
such a combination, is it, being sort of home educated on the Bible in a breaker's yard? So presumably she could rail about religion and also crush a car at short notice.
Yeah. There's all sorts of hilarious anecdotes of her doing just that.
Yes.
Of crushing cars and stuff, and all the terrifying sort of disregard for health and safety. Yes. 11-year-old girl wandering around with a chainsaw and stuff,
Yes.
All sorts of injuries went on.
She's still with us, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
She's still out there. She's at Harvard and beyond. Yeah.
She's still a very young woman. She's been to Harvard and Cambridge, and then she's written this book.
Maybe you're going to pass the golden baton to her. I've no idea.
I'd love her. She's amazing. I mean, if you get hold of her, I've followed her on, seen interviews with her on YouTube, and she's extraordinary. She's really.
So just say her name again. It's Tara.
Tara Westover.
Thank you. So she'll do brilliantly as an inspiration. And then the third one of those.
Well, there's actually, I've got another two. So one was Elliot Page's book, Page Boy, and Elliot, who's a trans man, grew up in the wrong body, but in the full glare of Hollywood, and was nominated for Best Actress for an Oscar for Juno when he was still a girl. And reading his challenges from really early memories, just this feeling of being in the wrong body and no one listening to it, and doing it in the full glare of the publicity of his life, I found it inspiring, just so inspiring that I guess like me growing up a gay boy in the 80s, there was no one to talk to. There was no one to talk, and to see the way that he handled that and the excruciating pain that he suffered was very moving. And then seeing him triumph as he has and kind of brilliantly just playing male roles now, it's wonderful. And the third was Viola Davis's memoir, Finding Me, which... Again, I mean, the way she describes her childhood to end up where she is now, as one of Hollywood's finest and best known and respected actresses, it inspires me. I kind of think, I had a few things up, but I never had to confront those things. To completely change, to leave my family behind me, and to find a way in an industry steeped in prejudice and yet keeping on going. And I just have the utmost respect for it. And I'm just a huge fan of her acting anyway. So yes. Even if she hadn't been, it's still a remarkable feat. But
yes,
she's also incidentally, I think, one of the finest actresses on screen at the moment. I think that's really something. Yeah. So those are my... Yeah, three there.
Wonderful. Three inspirations. Fantastic.
Yes.
And by the way, there's a slight comic tangent. As you were a gay boy growing up in Holland, I was growing up similarly in Uganda, not as a gay boy living in Uganda, but my only stereotypical knowledge of Holland was a first school assembly where we just knew the story of the person that had to put their finger in the light. So that's just a comedy tangent of, you know, all the sort of fna of sticking your finger in a dike and all that sort of thing. So anyway, that's a comedy tangent, which is wholly irrelevant. That's a rabbit hole.
Yes, thank you. Chris. Thank you.
So we're on to two squirrels now. What never failed to grab your attention, but your monsters of distraction, irrespective of anything else that's going on for you in your life, Robert Hands?
Well, I think movie posters. I love them. I don't just love the information that they have. I just think they're beautiful artworks. Mm. I know a little bit about it, that there are whole departments in Hollywood, that there are teams of people that create movie posters that decide, you know, it's not just, we'll just snap it, you know, from the action. There's a lot of thought goes behind it. And that's why some of them are so arresting.
Do you collect them, by the way?
I don't. I wish I did. I think I might start.
I think you should. Now you've said that, I was thinking, gosh, why doesn't he have them plastered all over the walls behind
him? Why don't I? Exactly.
And what's that poster behind you, by the way? Because that's a
meditation.
It's what?
That picture there. Yeah, no, it's a sort of, it's by a Bauhaus. It was a 1930s. 20s art.
Sorry, I made that was a squirrel of itself for me because I got distracted. What? So I'm terribly sorry. So back to you and your Hollywood posters.
Not Hollywood posters, but any old cinema poster, actually. On the tube, I gravitate towards them always and read who's in them, who's directed it, who's written it, I always do, and I love it, and I love them as works of art as well. So you're right. Why don't I? I'm going to get some, Chris.
Get some. And you've just, for some reason, the Betty Blue poster flashed into my mind as you said that. That was one that was very sort of iconic and memorable. That's not a very good example. There are many, many more brilliant ones, but that's one I remember. On some
Poor Things. I don't know if you've seen Poor Things, but the poster's so eye-catching. I find myself going to it the whole time. And I suppose I still have that passion for who's in it. What have they done before?
From your programmes, yes, absolutely.
My programme days.
And reading the Times theatre section, yes.
Yeah. Yes, I think it probably is, yes.
Okay, so that's your squirrels, I think, just in the structure.
One squirrel, I need another squirrel. My other squirrel.
Yes, you have another squirrel. It was what?
Any form of autobiography or biography catches my attention. It doesn't mean it doesn't matter if it's a book or whether it's, I think in the Metro, there's a thing called 60 Seconds, and then they have a sort of a snap interview with someone. Always gets my attention. I always read them. I love knowing, I suppose, to say I don't love knowing what makes people tick is maybe, I guess I do. I love knowing the nitty gritty about why they do things and I guess the differences in how people perceive things. And anything like that.
Yes.
Again, I think my mother used to get the Sunday Times, and there always used to be a thing on the back of it called The Day in the Life. I still do. I would always pick it up and read it.
Yes. Lovely.
Yes. So those would be my squirrels, I'd say.
And now, a quirky or unusual fact about you. This is the one that we couldn't possibly know about you until you tell us, and you're not allowed to say, I injected crystal meth once, because we know that now.
Well, I don't know if it's very interesting, but I don't eat sugar, by which I mean cakes, biscuits, chocolates, sweets, for 11 months of the year.
Ooh.
But in December, I cane it.
You're Captain Stollen all the way through December.
That's exactly it, yes.
I love that. You just have a sort of complete feast of binge of cake in December.
Yes. I can't do it like normal people do, who might say, oh, it'd be nice to have a bar of chocolate now. I can't. The minute I do that, I'm having family packs of fruit and nuts. And, you know, I don't know. Marks and Spencer's used to do these fantastic tea cakes, which aren't cakes at all. They're marshmallows with chocolate on. I think they came in boxes of 36, and I just ate all of them. I can't. Yes,
sort of like your Tunnock Snowball, but in a packet of 36.
Yes. The M&S version. And yeah. I can't do it in any way reasonably. And much like every any addiction I've ever had, actually, is I just sit there thinking about when am I going to have the next one? Where am I going to get the next one? What will the next one be? And it's easier for me, although it requires quite a lot of willpower, just not to do it. Just don't.
I love the
it.
Fact that December, you just think you go full feral and turn into Fatty Arbuckle because you can just go mental for a month.
I mean, I couldn't. I mean, never to have a mince pie again. I couldn't.
Yeah, I couldn't not. Yeah. Great fact. I love that.
I don't know if it's, but I listened to your interview with Fiona McDermott, and he was so brilliant because his hidden fact, it sort of incorporated his whole career, his whole reason for being was because of that fact that no one would know about him. That's in a way what drove him to become the man that he is. And I thought that was brilliant. So, you know, the one that I don't eat sugar isn't quite as interesting, but that's there you are. That's it.
No, yours is up there. This whole path and this trajectory of you, the story behind the story of Robert Hans is just extraordinary so far. This is gold in them thar hills right there. We have shaken your tree, and thank you for the mention of the lovely, brilliant Fiona McDermott in that as well. And now we've shaken your tree, so now we're going to stay in the clearing, move away from the tree. And by the way, the really good news is I think I'm going to milk about two whole episodes out of you because this is going on a really beautiful amount of time, which is great. So as we were. So now we're moving away from the tree, and next we're talking about alchemy and gold. When you're at purpose, Robert Hans, Ector, what are you absolutely happiest doing in what you're here to reveal to the world?
It's never changed since I was auditioning for drama school. I'm at my happiest working on a script and feeling unjudged, the ability to play, to try things out, to think about it, to search, to try and find clues of the character that I'll be playing. It's my happy place, and I can do it for hours and hours and hours, and I don't feel any less. It's almost meditative because I don't think of anything else while I'm doing it. I don't feel any less fond of all of that than I did all those years ago.
Lovely. And one of the other things I remember reading about you in the research towards your sort of darker time when your life imploded was you said there was a moment when you said, I hadn't worked for 2 years. And I wonder whether it was the gap of not being able to go to that alchemic place that made you more susceptible to ultimately the sinkhole of addiction you went into. But I don't know if the two of those are correlated.
No, I didn't work because I was taking drugs.
I'm with you. Sorry.
Yes.
Sorry, that's my fault. But I love the fact that it's all about that is your happy place. At your most alchemic, you're working on a script. How lovely.
Yeah.
And now, it's not December, but I'm going to award you with it's going to have to be a metaphorical cake because you're not allowed even to snaffle anything.
No, because I'm going to save it up, Chris.
So what type of cake would you like? Imagine it's now December the 1st. What are we nomming on?
Here's the thing. I think because I don't eat cake the rest of the year, and it is my passion, what I like, if that's okay, is
yes.
I go, you know those posh hotels where they have afternoon tea?
I do.
And they come with a selection of little cakes, don't you?
On yes. The, sort of, on some little fences. Cake.
Yes. And what I thought I'd have was I'd have a little slice of lemon drizzle, and I'd have a little slice of vanilla, Victoria sponge, and then I'd have coffee and walnut, and then I might have a little slice of fruitcake as well.
How quintessentially gorgeous. I love that. You can have all those things on a little delicate sort of tower of plates.
It what's might that? Add up to slightly more than one chunky slice, but only just. Essentially, it'd be like
And what's that tower of different sized plates called when you...
Is it called a... It's not called a... It's not called a Lazy Susan, is it? No.
Is it, or a carousel, a Lazy Susan?
I don't know what they're called.
We have to get people to write in about that.
Sandwiches on the bottom, don't you? And
yes.
Then on the top, you've got little bits of cake.
Yeah, so if one said, look, there's one of those plates. I wonder what it's called. Do you think it's a Lazy Susan, do you?
I don't think it is.
Carousel.
I think a Lazy Susan is a thing that spins in the middle of the table. So that if you're sitting at a big table, you can turn it around. So if you want to get the sprouts or whatever, and they're the ones on the other side of the thing, you can turn. I think that's a lazy Susan. Rather than having to pass them, you can just turn the...
I remember being at a Chinese restaurant when the table rotated and you could spin the bits round, but that wouldn't be a lazy Susan in a Chinese restaurant, I'm sure. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be racist or anything. I'm sure it's not that. Anyway, I'm sorry. Cashier number 412, please. You can have the lovely potpourri of cakes. I love that. You've got a quintessential English collection of cakery, which is lovely. Yes. Okay, now you get to put the cherry on the cakes that you have. And this is stuff like, what's a favourite inspirational quote, Robert, that's always given you succour and pulled you towards your future?
Oh, I've had many that I thought might do, but one that makes me smile was two. Can I have two?
Yes.
One is from the film Flashdance. And it's take your passion and make it happen. And I love it for two reasons. One, because I like the sentiment. It's essentially go for it. But also the fact it doesn't really rhyme. Passion doesn't rhyme with happen. But I like the fact that it's quite shameless the way they've done that. But the thought behind it, which is, go for it. You take your passion and make it happen. I like that. But I think the other one, quite lowbrow, my quotations, is RuPaul's famous line, which is, if you can't love yourself, how the hell do you expect anyone else? How do you expect to love anyone yourself? And I like the fact that that's not about what can you get, but what can you give? How can you give anyone anything unless you love yourself?
Yes.
And I think that's a nice one.
And I don't think that's lowbrow at all. I think that's absolutely gorgeous. Now, this next question I'm particularly enamoured with, because you said a little bit a while ago, you said, I do feel actually a little bit in love or affectionate towards that little boy, you said about yourself. Yes. So my next question is, what notes, help or advice now with the extraordinary cathartic path you've had, with the gift of hindsight, what notes, help or advice would you proffer to a younger 10-year-old version of a Robert Hands?
I think I'd say, trust your instincts. Don't diminish yourself by what you think other people want you to be. I think is what I'd say, which is quite complicated to a small boy. But I think he'd understand, actually. I think the notion that someone is going to thank me on my deathbed for not living my best life is quite sobering. I kind of think, who am I doing this for? Mm. So much of my life has been... I mean, much like the blokes said, here, have some crystal meth. And I said, yes. Why did I do that? I kind of did it because I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I don't know why I did it.
Yes.
Rather than trust my instincts.
That's the most dangerous type of people-pleasing known to man, probably.
It's really exceptional. It's Olympic level of people-pleasing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. And that's a very interesting segue into this next question, which is... I know you've been given some crap advice. Obviously, we've just covered that. But what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
What is the best piece of advice I've ever been given? I tell you, the most helpful thing someone has ever said to me was, because I really struggled, and I think bullied children do struggle with this blame. You blame yourself. And I've been in a few West End musicals, and so as part of that was I had singing lessons, and I had some vocal issues. And one of the problems that I had a sort of real problem is my mouth was closing up a lot, and seemingly it was about that sort of territory. It was about the carrying the burden of having been bullied and stuff. And he just said, it's not your fault. And it was like I was let off the hook with that. And so, that's one of the most memorable things anyone's ever said to me. And it landed. Sometimes people can say things and you go, oh, yeah, that's nice, thank you. But it really landed because it never occurred to me it wasn't my fault. Mm. And it allowed me to let go of it a little bit and to forgive myself a little bit.
Lovely.
It's gone heavy again, honestly.
No, it's great. This is just...
Lightened the cake and now here I am back again.
No, lovely. Because now where we're going is we're ramping up to Shakespeare in a moment to talk about legacy.
Oh, God, yes.
Just before we get there, this is the pass the golden baton moment, please. So having experienced this from within, who would you most like to pass the golden baton along to someone in your life or network in order to keep the golden thread of the storytelling going?
I'd like to pass it on to my friend Mickey Cohen.
Mickey Cohen.
He is a jewellery designer and maker, and he has helped me more than anyone else in the world. He's helped me with my journey to spirituality. He's helped me through his tireless selflessness. He's always there for me. He has he's a family and children, but he's always there for me. And I'm very lucky to have him in my life because he inspires me. He could have been on the inspiration list, actually. In fact, he should have been on the inspiration list because no matter what his difficulties may be, he's a man all about service. He does service to mankind all the time. And without any expectation of any gain or anything, he does it because it helps him and it makes the world a better place. It's a selfless, even when it's inconvenient, he still does it. Inconvenient to him, he still is there. And in my darkest hours, when I was struggling with trying to stay off the drugs, he was always there, and he threw open the doors to his house to me and invited me to go on family holidays. And he's a very kind and inspiring man, a very special human being, and without in any way being limited by any actual religion. He's just, as to me, he's a spiritual giant. And I think he's very special, and he's a creative man. He makes beautiful jewellery. So he might be someone up your street. I don't know. It's up to you.
He sounds like a privilege. And I can't resist saying, because he's a jeweller, he's obviously a bit of a gem. So yes, he sounds really, really extraordinary, actually. And thank you. He sounds like a very great gift of a golden baton pass. Thank you very much.
Spiritual leaders come in many different guises. And I wouldn't have thought, Mickey wouldn't immediately think, oh, there goes a spiritual guru. But
yes, so your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to furnish me with a warm introduction to Mickey Cohen. Thank you very much. And now, inspired by Shakespeare and all the worlds of stage, and by the way, you may be interested to know, this is the actual, not first folio, but this is the actual complete works that I bought to go to the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, where I met you. And this says Chris Grimes, 16986. So this is the actual one that I used when we were chuntering on together in the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School.
Charging over the downs, doing King Henry, Henry V. Do you ever do that?
Yes, over a muse of fire and all that shebang. Lovely. Yes, and of course, we can riff on about that another time as well. The people that we were there with and all that stuff. Marvellous. So now, inspired by Shakespeare then, and inspired by Jakeley's speech in As You Like It, All the World's Deeded, All the Bed, you don't have to do any Shakespeare. This is just legacy now, Robert Hands. How, when all is said and done, it's a lot of kerfuffle and a big prop just for one question, isn't it? But it's how would you most like to be remembered?
I think I'd like... I suppose, I've struggled and I've come out the other end. And I suppose, yes, if I'd like to be remembered, maybe someone that maybe gave hope to someone who was struggling and didn't know there was a way out of it. I'd love that. You said, how would you hope to be? So I don't know whether I'll ever be, but that would be a wonderful legacy, to think that if it was just one person.
It's not hope, it's how do you most like. So this is your gift to give. So it's how would you most like to be remembered. So I'm not being pedantic. I'm just saying that it needn't be a hope, because actually you are an inspiration, because you have survived it and you've survived.
Yeah, well, that's how I'd like to be remembered then. Someone that overcame some difficulties and came out the other end. After dumbfounded for the first time.
No, I'm leaving a little bit of silence there. Marvellous. No, that's fine. So, where can we find out all about Robert Hands on the old interweb, please?
Probably Instagram, rob.hands.
Lovely. Thank you. As this has been your moment in the sunshine in the Good Listening To show, Stories of Distinction and Genius, Robert Hands, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No, but thank you, Chris, for asking me. It's lovely to see you. You don't look any different.
Well, nor do you. And yes, it's one. It's thank you for that. I shall take that as a compliment. And it's so, so wonderful to see you again. I'm so happy we have reconnected. Yeah. And in the last few months, I've reconnected with Brendan O'Hay, with you and others that are there in the mix of the wonderful squad that we were part of back in the day. So it's been a real, real delight. And as I said at the beginning, I'm so profoundly happy that you have come through it and you are the right way up and wiser for it. But my gosh, you went there. You had to, you were sucked under, and it's great that you have surfaced and emerged triumphant, but with still work to be done, because it ain't over yet, as we know, life.
Thank you.
Wonderful. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the delightful Robert Hands. And yes, I've been Chris Grimes. TheGoodListeningToShow.com is the website. Tune in next time for more stories from The Clearing. Thank you very much indeed. And good night.
You've been listening to The Good Listening To Show here on UK Health Radio with me, Chris Grimes. Oh, it's my son.
If you've enjoyed the show, then please do tune in next week to listen to more stories from The Clearing.
If you'd like to connect with me on LinkedIn, then please do so. There's also a dedicated Facebook group for the show too. You can contact me about the programme, or if you'd be interested in experiencing some personal impact coaching with me, care of my Level Up Your Impact programme, that's chris@secondcurve.uk. On Twitter and Instagram, it's
@thatchrisgrimes.
So until next time, for me, Chris Grimes, from UK Health Radio, and from Stan,
to your good health.
Goodbye.
So, actor Robert Hands, you've just been given a damn good listening to. Can I just ask for your immediate feedback on what that was like for you, being curated through this structure and this storyscape?
It was very nice. It's quite nice talking about yourself. I was a bit worried about it before, because I thought, oh dear, it is all a bit grim and dark, and do I really want to talk about this? Well, I'm glad I did. You gently led me through it, and it just feels quite auspicious, it being, you know, my 10-year anniversary, and talking to you about it. And I guess it was very nice. And I wasn't feeling very well when I started, but I feel much better now.
And thank you for not postponing being as you weren't well, because we've had a really interesting path. It is profound that it's 10 years to this day, even though we've tried four times to get to this point.
And really four times, yeah.
And that, you know, it's wonderful that it was today. And thank you sincerely. It's lovely that we're both here with our man colds 10 years to the day of your recovery. But it's just really, it's the right time. You know, what's meant for you won't pass you by. And here we are. And it's been lovely.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
And thank you for watching on Facebook, too. If you have been, do get in touch with Rob if you'd like to do that. And it's been a joy. And I hope to see you again. I'd very much look forward to giving you a hug when I next see you.
That'd be nice. Yeah, me too.